This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicide, take it.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and joining me for the 154th minute of Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus is a really talented and really scarily prolific film voice. I discovered her on Twitter. I've since learned that she's a multi-time national award-winning scribe, screenwriter, self-professed movie encyclopedia, and a tennis fan, which, if on Twitter is to be true, a tennis fan. So, I mean, there may even be a tennis digression in this episode of One Heat Minute. There already has been one, a random discussion around slow motion cameras being used to show how beautiful Roger Federer does a backhand. But now we have the incredible Jen Johans. Jen, welcome to One Heat Minute.
Wow. Well, I can't live up to that, but I would love to about Roger Federer any day of the week. So, you know, if you follow this up with a whole Roger Federer hour, count me in as well.
I'm sorry. There's no more. There will be no tennis podcast. We can unequivocally say that there will be no tennis version of this show. Before we dive in and talk to Jen more just about everything and her relationship with film and with Heat, let's jump into the minute. We just, if you were listening, the 153rd episode covered a pretty significant minute in the film as far as character building for Vincent Hanna. And Jen's minute right now really dives into, you know, it has this coda with the wonderful Diane Venora before we get into another like really extreme moment of the film. So I thought we'd just dive straight in. We'd listen to it. We'd talk a little bit about the minute, and then we can talk to Jen about her writing of film and her writing just in general and about this minute. So, and her relationship with Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus Heat. So if this is your first episode, welcome. And we'll dive into this minute right now. Jen and I are going to watch together. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
Yeah. Security, there's a fire on 3. We have to evacuate all the floors.
I can't leave here. Look, why don't we just talk about this a bit, huh, brother?
There it is, Jen.
Okay. All right. That is one intense minute there.
It is. It starts with a poor, deflated Diane Venora just sort of devastated and acting tough for tough's sake, and then just sort of accepting that Vincent Hanna is just out the door, enjoying skipping down those steps. And then an extremely intent Robert De Niro as Neil McCauley wandering down that hallway, discovering Wayne Grove hiding in that room as Jameson, and just by the luxury of the chaos he's created, they don't spot him. And yeah, that kick to that door and is
feel that kick. Definitely.
It is a pretty intense thing. So you're a writer,
yes,
screenwriter. You have a relationship to this movie somewhat. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, you seeing this film and your impressions of this film, and is it something that sort of sticks with you? Because I know that you are if you go to filmintuition.com, you're incredibly prolific on reviews and particularly a focus on female directors and female creatives. But in this big gargantuan beast of a thing, what's your relationship to it?
I actually saw this opening weekend back in 95.
Wow.
Yes. I used to hang out with my older brother and all of his friends. I was like the only girl in the group, and we would go to the movies like every weekend. So I saw this thing opening weekend, and it was back in Minnesota, so it was freezing. So then the joke for the entire winter was, you know, make like Al Pacino and turn up the heat. And really lame jokes like that. But I am the only girl you're probably going to ever encounter who had a crush on Robert De Niro, like in the 90s. So I had a poster of Goodfellas in my room. Like
oh my most goodness.
Girls, I know, like, you know, New Kids on the Block.
Luke
no,
Perry, it forget awful. It. Forget it. It's yeah. Robert De Niro or nothing for Jen.
Italian on my mom's side. So we watched the Godfather series like every year. So I was very excited to get like a predominantly Robert De Niro minute. Of course, I mean, I'd be thrilled to talk about Al Pacino as well. But yeah, no, this was perfect.
I was just going to say to you, I just want to let you know, my friend, my dear friend Maria Lewis, who's done this podcast, she's an author as well and a screenwriter. Funnily enough, if you guys looked at some of your sort of skill set, it's like screenwriters, novelists, film writers. She doesn't love this film at all. And I haven't asked you yet whether you like it, but she doesn't love this film. But she said she did text me at the time she was watching it for the first time. And she said, I wasn't prepared for how attracted I am to Robert De Niro in this movie. I wasn't prepared for it. So I think, you know, you're totally, you're not the first girl that I've heard that, but you're definitely the first girl that I've ever heard was crushing on him hard at a time when Luke Perry existed. So it's awesome. It's very awesome.
Definitely. No, I love the film. It was really intense in 95 because Casino came out.
Yes.
I want to say, come out like a... Yeah, exactly. And I saw that one opening weekend as well. And so it was two totally different De Niro's. But what was interesting is I was thinking about both films. He has this controlled presence throughout.
Yes.
You know, Pesci is the one who has the elevated emotions in Casino, and here it's Al Pacino screaming, which until I found out he was playing like as if he was high a little bit, it was kind of like, you know, chew the scenery, why don't you, a little bit. Like, some of those scenes kind of drove me nuts. I mean, there's so much fun to imitate and quote and, you know, all of the above. But until I learned that piece of it, and then it really made sense. But I was more like, you know, it was an interesting balance between the two men. And yeah, I was definitely drawn to the De Niro character. It's always interesting with man because he's an existentialist.
Big
he
time.
Loves these where, you know, the cop or robber, they're always willing to risk or forsake any kind of chance at happily ever after. Even the prospect of it, to just right some wrong in their life or tip the scales of justice the way they see fit. You see it in Thief. You see it in Manhunter, of course, Heat. Pacino has that line about all I am is who I'm going after. But like so much of this movie, it could also apply to Neil. And it does, especially here. They're both in pursuit of suspects, unbeknownst to Vincent, they have one in common.
Yeah,
he's a serial killer. So that's always fascinated me, that how much the two men have in common. And the other thing I love about his movies is the recurring theme of why would you want to live a simple life?
Yes.
There's even like a really rude way of putting it. I'm sure you remember in Thief, James Caan tells his love interest, like, what are you doing that's so terrific? And it was kind of like,
it's the James Caan Tuesday World coffee shop scene is like an old timer. Like, it's the old timer meet cute, because it's like there's nothing cute about it. He's like, what the fuck is your life so special for, you know? It's so like devoid of artifice, which is great. And I think one of the major reasons why that movie, you know, continues to play so beautifully, it's because it's like, it's so shocking to get people actually being candid in a conversation that is always so staged, whether it's in cinema or real life, you know, that first meet. It's you're performing your best self. But I love about James Caan is like, no one, James Caan doesn't have, you know, his best self is him all day. It's who he is.
I know. And man carries that through. I mean, Collateral might be my favorite one after Heat of his movies. And there's that entire thing about his, oh, this is just temporary. Well, how long have you been doing this? 12 years. So it kind of, the same thing throughout all of these movies.
Can I just say, let's just pause on that moment. That if you ever want to see a brilliant reaction shot, like it is Tom Cruise reacting as a character named Vincent too. Tom Cruise reacting to Jamie Foxx's character saying that. So he's like, oh, it's temporary. And he goes, oh yeah, how long is that? 12 years. Like Tom Cruise's eyes and his eyebrows in that scene. Like, that needs to be a meme. Like, can someone tell me how to design a GIF? Because it just needs to happen of, like, if someone tells you a reaction, if someone says something you're not expecting, you need the Tom Cruise face from Collateral in that exact moment. It is just perfection. He's like, what? 12 years is not temporary, bro. That's a lifetime.
Yes, it is. Definitely. The other thing that always fascinates me about Heat is how much of the movie is cyclical and how many scenes from earlier on like pay off.
Yes.
Like the first time Neil tries to kill Wayne Grove, the heat comes around the corner and Wayne Grove vanishes.
Yes.
Now he had his whole crew with them and he still couldn't kill the guy. And what is the tragedy of Neil is now that his crew is, you know, mostly dead, basically.
Yes.
He still wants to do it. And it's like, if he would have thought about it, you know, the heat is going to be coming around the corner again.
The heat is in a room around the corner, literally. Like, we're seeing, cutting two, and the heat is all over the place. The hotel is crawling with it.
I know. It's just heartbreaking to think about it. But I do love the fact that, I mean, it's a tremendous victory for him to be able to kill Wayne Grove. Of course, this like segues a little bit later into the next minute. I do apologize, but I do love that it's in a hotel because that's where Wayne Grove has been, you know, dispatching call girls all over town. So it's kind of like, again, with Michael Mann and the symbolism and things coming back, the death of Wayne Grove happens where he's killing people.
Yeah.
Which I always kind of, you know, cold justice, basically.
Yeah, I think one thing you said there, which is so spot on, is cyclical natures, lovely little echoes and nods, huge amount of payoffs. But also, it's so nice to see how vulnerable Wayne Grove is in this hotel, you know, because in that sleazy dive with the dead crow, he's like a snake in a den, you know, he slithers and you know, that poor unsuspecting prostitute in her, you know, pretty wig who's used to lying to grotesque men in hotel rooms, just doesn't know, you know, and Wayne Gross says that, you know, that's a haunting and devilish line, you know. You know, you don't know what this is. And so what's wonderful here is he's lapping up his comfort, he's got a robe on. There's just also something so deeply deeply satisfying the justice, you know, this right being wronged, because he's so comfortable. He's so happy. He's like, I've done all this stuff. And I guess that's just the masterstroke of, you know, because we've seen Neil be a bad guy for like a chunk of the movie to this point. For about 50 minutes, he's not been a nice person. But we're still so on his side in this moment particularly, because in the grand scheme of the universe, Wayne Grove is a guy that shouldn't exist. And whether Vincent chases him down and catches him in the act in this series that we know is ongoing, or Neil gets him here, kind of we're satisfied either way.
Yes, definitely. And he's willing to do it. It's again, one of those Michael Mann things of the escape is just there. They always want to go out of the city to a place with water. I mean, you see that, like, they have the paradise there in Manhunter, and then he has to leave the water. And anytime they go for any kind of calm and beef, they're at water. So he wants to escape from the city. And it just, it kills you. He's, like, right by the airport. But no, one more stop. And
right.
Yeah. I think you had that Zeitz through the tunnel. Didn't you have him on for that whole, when he hears where Wingrow is and he decides, nope, one more stop. Yes. And it's perfect for it. Yeah. It's just heartbreaking. He can't escape his nature, just like Vincent. I'm sorry, I stepped over you right there.
No, I love it. No, totally fine. And what I was going to say, though, is you're right about that, like, that you said something at the beginning of the show, Jen, that, like, I think is so perfect for these characters, and I think it's a massive one, is, like, you said that the characters in Mann films often forego happily ever after to right a wrong or to, like, tip the scales of justice. And I think that that's their great tension, is that they stare out to this sublime ocean, usually, like, that this potential future, this paradise that they often is a fantasy that they've made up for themselves. So that, and it's almost like they're telling themselves that there is a fantasy right there to justify the behaviors that they're doing right now. It's like they're promising themselves a future where they're going to be easier on themselves and easier on, you know, easier on their discipline, easier on their programming. And it's the kind of, in a way, it's that kind of self-deception. But what's really great as we come to the rubber hitting the road, literally your minute is, you know, wedged between these two massive rubber hit the roads moments, is like when Vincent gets given permission by Justine to leave, you know, Petunia gets permission to leave by Diane Venora's wonderful character. And she sort of collapses and has to deal with the emotional weight of now being a single mom, you know, taking care of a daughter who's, you know, experiencing some real, you know, traumatic emotional thoughts. And obviously he's gone through some physical trauma in an attempt at suicide. You know, Vincent skipping down those stairs to go back into predator mode, to go back into hunter mode, you know, that's where he actually for a moment, and he admits, he's like, all I am is what I'm going after. And, like, he, yep, in that moment, he actually knows himself to be true. And, like, Neil right now is making time to keep the programming, but in just minutes' time, not even, it's a couple of minutes away, he's gonna follow his discipline to a T. The heat's gonna be around the corner, and in 60 seconds flat, he's gonna look at his whole life, which is Edie, you know, this promise of this fantasy going to New Zealand, and he's just gonna take a massive left turn and just get the hell out of there. Because he's going to follow his programming.
Yes, exactly. And it's almost, he follows his programming. Also, I think when he acts on an impulsive idea, like, he hasn't thought this out fully.
No.
He seems to, I mean, he got up the stairs. He made it, I know it was the crazy shot where the guy is looking out the window and he should be looking at Wingrow. I mean, he made it there and he had, like, the dumb luck to do it. But that was just kind of dumb luck. And for the entire movie, part of the genius of Neil was knowing when to walk away. Like, yeah, one of my favorite sequences in the entire thing, when they hear the cop and he just walks over to Val Kilmer, like, we walk. And they do.
Yes.
And here he can't stop himself. And I think it's maybe because it just happened. He's acting on emotion, which is different for Neil. I mean, you know, he still has that cold precision, which he carries throughout the entire film. But you also hear it in the words that he says to Wingrow when he repeats, man loves to repeat lines. And I think also, so do the actors.
Yeah, De Niro loves a line repeat. Loves it. To make sure the actors listen. To make sure his co-performers are listening to him.
Yes, exactly. And I think you get that a little bit when he tells Wangro, look at me, and he repeats it like 3 times. And it shows that, you know, there's absolutely no mistaking that this killing is anything but like very personal. It's not the clinical, okay, this is our job, this is what we're doing. It's I'm taking him out. And I think it's a different shade of Neil than we've seen throughout the entire film a little bit.
Yeah. And what's so great is, you know, even though we've seen Neil attempt this, what's so great is that when Wangro looks out that viewfinder and it kind of dawns on him that it might be Neil, like he's not 100% sure, but it kind of dawns on him that it might be Neil, there is a real significant change in like the weather of his face. He's like,
first, the brother line.
Yeah, like, can we just talk about this brother? Like, it's like,
yeah. All like the it's talk, on.
All the talk, all the negotiation, all the slipperiness that he's been, all the evasive actions that he's been able to pull in his life. It's like, you know, you just want to, you're hearing a line over and over in your head. It's like, bro, you don't know what this is. The Grim Reaper is visiting upon you right now. You know, that same line that he says to that poor unwitting prostitute, like, no.
Yeah.
The Grim Reaper is here. And it's just that wonderful poetic justice right there. That's about to happen to him. And I just even in just everything, the fear in his face that starts there, and we can, you know, as Neil McCauley does, we can break the discipline of this show and pivot to the minute slightly after, is that, you know, when that happens, you know, the look at me thing is, I want you to have the certainty that you know that I'm the guy that's killing you. I don't want to, there's no pretense that it's anyone else. It's me.
Yeah. And like the worst things we've seen Neil do, like that is probably the coldest, even though the audience is totally on his side.
Yes.
And what's interesting is, I mean, he doesn't even know how bad Wangro is, really.
No.
He knows, you know, betrayed his crew and he did all these things, but he has no idea what's been going on around town. It's interesting that, you know, he and Vincent have no idea that they have another intersection in their relationship. I mean, these men are linked to each other so much, and they know it a little bit. I think they can sense it, but they have no idea how deep it goes. And I found that fascinating that the linchpin is, of course, Wangro of all people, but it was interesting.
Yeah. What's so ballsy about this movie is just that man can leave that secondary entanglement by the wayside and just let it all happen for us as the audience, and that can still go unresolved, and it just gives you that ache that, you know, Vincent's gonna have an interesting moment where he realizes that when this series of murders stops and they start to find some physical evidence, they're like, oh, we've got that blood record on file. It's the guy who died. It's the guy who Neil McCauley shot. Like, just to wonder what's going to be going through his head when that little discovery dawns on him is going to be very, very interesting indeed. So it's one of those little, those tantalizing tidbits that happens.
I know, for sure.
I love that. Yes. I love when you see through the police's camera that it's undeniably Neil McCauley standing outside of Wangro's room, the very thing they want to see, and all the chaos that he's created outside just has the cop looking out the window. And everything, all the chaos of LA is there, and you just love it. You're like, oh, of course the cop's right then. It's the moment, you know, we've seen the guys not really take it seriously. They were playing cards before. It's totally plausible that they're just checking out the window to see
you know,
to see whether this evacuation is legitimate. And that's it.
I know. And it bothers you. Like, wouldn't that send off something? Like, all of a sudden there's a fire alarm. I mean, at the very time you're supposed to be watching this guy, but it doesn't. And of course it doesn't.
Like one of the cops goes, at least he does. I think the plausibility thing, cause you gotta, it's like this internal bullshit test that we have with a movie. Like, at least there's, if there were still two cops in that room, you'd go, that's ridiculous. But because they do the business to build us up to at least say in the previous minutes that they're like, one of the cops goes to actually legitimately investigate whether there is a fire. Like, what was the source of the alarm? Where did it go? This can't be right.
Mm-hmm,
the second cop, the second cop then lets the team down. Lets the team down significantly.
Though I guess that's the way, like, you know, when you're searching for something and you can't find it, of course he's looking out the window at the exact minute, you know?
Yes.
It's just like, yeah.
These are little, that's almost like a horror movie, of course, moment. Like, of course you're going to go down those stairs. We don't want you to go down those stairs. Of course you're going to be doing that. And it doesn't belabor the point, so it's not frustrating. But it's like, he does hear the gunshot.
Yeah, exactly.
And he makes his way out, and he's just trying to. And but he does the smart thing as well as a cop. Like he just wants to subdue Neil. He doesn't want to just shoot him. He wants to stop him.
I know, and I respected that. I actually asked a police officer, because when Vincent runs after him and he takes two shots at Neil, and I'm like, you know, you're not really supposed to shoot people if they're running. I said, because of the bank scene, though, because of the level of chaos, like so much harm that could happen, he actually does have the right. And I'm like, oh, okay, you know, I'm just anything to try to save Neil in my head. I'm like, come on, you know.
Wait. We just have to clarify that point. Jen Johans just said on One Hit Minute that she just was so smitten with Robert De Niro that she had to make sure that Vincent Hanna was following proper police procedure in the pursuit to make sure that, you know, it was still okay in her mind. I mean, if that doesn't earn you a spot in the Hall of Fame of this show, I don't know what is, because asking questions on the behalf of fictional characters that you crush on, I think is just outstanding. So thank you, Jen, for that moment on this show, I have to say.
I should probably say my uncle growing up worked Vice and I babysat cops. So like I'm familiar with the police terrain, but I was just thinking about that. Yeah, like, you know, does he have the right? Because growing up and watching so many movies, I remember watching one with a friend. And I'm like, why don't they just shoot him? And they can't shoot a guy when he runs. And so, yeah, so that always stuck with me. And I'm like, so I had to check it out. But nope, Pacino was in the right.
Well, that's
even though, of course, dating.
Even though, of course, you wanted Neil, you don't want him to do what it is so inevitable. But, you know, during this show, way back, and for folks who are listening, I'll get the exact episode. I believe it's the 70th episode of the show. I had an Australian federal police officer come onto the show. I'll just find the exact minute so I can point everyone out to it. Yes, it was the 70th minute. And an Australian federal police detective who works in the organized crime division, and his name is redacted because he's still an active investigator. And I sort of asked him, you know, he loves the movie and he's a big fan, and in Australia, a completely different, you know, criminal landscape and practices, I would assume, you know, vastly different, as well as being super similar for certain things. But one of the things that he said was, even if they, you know, I said, what's the one thing for you that you would do differently? And he said, because if these guys were the guys we suspected for doing for the armored car, but we weren't sure, and then we found them doing that that heist for the platinum, where the guy sitting down in the car alerts them to their presence, he goes, I would have pinched them right there. He goes, I don't care if they went to jail for 6 months. They're off the street for 6 months, and then I can build a case and, you know, make sure that when they get out, I can keep an eye on them, because I know that it's not going to be too long before, you know, they get into more mischief together. But, you know, that was that one thing, you know, from a really pure procedural, factual perspective, that I think that it's like, you know, by the time that Neil McCauley and his crew have done this, it's like cops are going to shoot first and ask questions later, I think, in this whole thing. Yeah. So the restraint of the cop who's observing that room is immense, to say the least.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a really good point that he had. And somebody does propose that to Vincent, if I remember right. Like, you know, what do we bust them for? And it was going to be too minimal. And so he just, you know, throw the fish back, I guess.
Yeah,
but
he made the call.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. And I do have, like you said, Hall of Fame. This will probably get me kicked off the Hall of Fame. When I was a kid, well, I don't know. Let's see, it came out in 95. So probably Christmas of 96, my brother gave me the VHS of Heat, and I gave him the VHS of Rocky. We wound up having to trade them because I didn't like to watch De Niro get killed. He didn't like Sly Stallone lose. So we traded them back. It was like, yeah, these are amazing movies, but, you know, the wrong thing. So, yeah, I just couldn't. It's like, no, I can't watch him die. You know, got to watch him be, you know, Corleone, or got to watch him do something else. Goodfellas. But, yeah. So. Yes.
Well, he read the part. That's so good. He read the part first. That's what is so cool. He read Neil McCauley and went, "I want that part."
Can you imagine if they were switched? I mean, I'm sure people have brought that up, and they would have done a great job. But you know, watching it, it's hard to imagine.
I can imagine it, but it's like it's really hard for me to imagine it. It's really hard for me to imagine it at that point of Pacino's career.
True, right after Son of a Woman, and yeah, definitely.
It's hard for me to imagine it then. But if you said this movie was made in 84, or 85 rather than 95, so 10 years earlier, I would totally have bought Pacino as a cold-blooded, like, not much coming out. Like, you only have to look at, you know, big chunks of Carlito's Way, Serpico, Michael Corleone, of course. There's so many movies where he does play really cold, very minimal, and just like insular. And you can totally see Pacino, like, De Niro, rather, all the way from Mean Streets. He's like a blackguard and talking nonsense and, you know, big braggadocious, you know, and that's kind of part of his charm in some of those movies.
Yeah. And actually like mid-80s, Midnight Run. So that was during his
of course
days.
Fun movie. And Grodin plays the straight man. Like he's the guy who's like, you know, very verbose and silly and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, that movie doesn't get enough credit. That is a brilliant. If you haven't seen, if you're listening to One Heat Minute right now, it's 154 minutes in. You need a break from, you know, watching De Niro
die,
yeah, as Jen did. And you don't have Rocky on hand. You need to have a search on the iTunes library or your video on demand service and seek out Midnight Run. It's just it's so good.
Yeah, Alonzo Mosley, FBI.
Yes.
Amazing. I know. Actually, I think both those lines.
And actually, De Niro, accurately hot wiring a car. You know, they took a lot of effort to show that in great detail, and just great. A movie that like should have had 10 sequels. They should have made one of those every couple of years forever. Totally great.
Did he really hot wire? I would believe he would. I mean, my favorite De Niro story is when Meryl Streep said he tried on 75 tan-colored jackets for Falling in Love to make sure, and he had her there to make sure it was like the right tan jacket. And I just was, she's like, it took forever. He would put it on, and I like look in the mirror. Is this the jacket of the guy? No, take it off. 75 of them. Anyway, I always love that story.
Oh my God. That is so good. And you can see Meryl, like, you know, a lot of conversation, especially when they talk about like the greatest American actors ever, skews towards dudes, you know, they're like, oh, it's Brando, De Niro, Pacino. But like, she's out of sight in the conversation of best ever. And she seems to be so much less, like she needs less, like accoutrement. She doesn't need as much of that physical, tangible stuff. She'll just get there, get in the moment, know her lines, and just crush it every single time.
Yeah.
And she doesn't need a lot of that other faff. It doesn't seem to help improve her performance. She just, you know, she'll get in there and be in anything, be in any dress, be in anything, and she's ready to go.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. And from one movie to the next, you're never sure which Meryl you're going to get, which is always always a treat.
And she seems to have sustained it. That's one thing that these guys, you know, that are in her similar class, and she's been in movies around these guys for such a long time, is that she seems to still just bring it. She's still bringing it every time. Great performance, every movie, great choices, you know, very rare misstep.
Yeah, she's actually of the, if you want to say, of the three, Pacino, De Niro, and her, she has the most exciting career right now. And
oh, yeah, by far.
That's rare. Yeah, very cool.
It is very, it, like, to say that, and also just consistently every, you know, it's kind of silly. You just go back through Oscar nomination years, and you're like, you just look at how many times she's been in a movie and almost, like, guaranteed with an Oscar nom, but so many of them are just great. You're like, wow, like, she didn't win for so many good movies. So many really good movies, consistently good, stack of different genres, stack of different roles, you know, really aged into performances as well. Like, you know, not being afraid to play, you know, a crazy mom, or, you know, those sorts of things. Going all over the map, musicals of recent years as well. Like, you know, really crushing it across the board. I didn't think we'd go on this deep a Meryl dive, but I think that it's essential to talk about with these guys, because hopefully they're about to turn it around in Scorsese's The Irishman, coming to Netflix a little bit later this year, so we can see what these guys are like together and just forget that. We can forget. What was that other movie? I don't even remember the name of it. What was that other terrible movie they did together?
Righteous Kill.
Oh, my goodness.
That was awful. Yeah. You know what I wish, though, speaking of Michael Mann, I wish he would have a female lead in one of these. I think it would be fascinating. Jada Pinkett Smith has a great role in
she does.
In Collateral. Yes. And the women of Heat, like, I totally forgot it had been so long that Ashley Judd was in it, and she was amazing. I mean, they're all amazing. Yes. But I do wish that he would have one lead character be a woman. I think it would make it an interesting dynamic to see, like, you know, one of these existential heroes make it a heroine.
I mean, look, you Miami Vice has Naomi Harris, you know, pre-Moonlight Naomi Harris, who is absolutely phenomenal, and Elizabeth Rodriguez as, like, two of the female leads besides Gong Li, who plays Isabella. I'm just like, if you're going to make everyone's dreaming of, like, let's make Michael Mann movie sequels, you know, there's a Heat prequel / sequel novel that's coming out, but I would love them to see, to go back to Heat and just have the partners be Elizabeth Rodriguez and Naomi Harris in that crew. And then you could still have Farrell and Fox bombing around, but, like, make those two the leads, and you know, I'd be all about that.
Yes, and have them be the ones tied up with bombs around their necks instead of the women this time.
Yes.
That would be cool. Yes. No, I mean, my face is, like, a lot of fun, but it was like, okay, one chick is tied up and then Gong Li's in trouble. It's like, can we go to a different well here? But I mean, it's a fun movie. My favorite part of that movie is how many times they say go fast boats. Like, every time they say that. But, yeah. Anyway,
I think
go fast boats.
If you have to drink every time someone says go fast boats, I think you're going to be absolutely, if you swig your mojito every time someone says go fast boats, and it's going to be absolute delirium. Look, this show, this episode has been a go fast boat, and it has been a go fast boat largely because of my guests, Jen Johans. Thank you so much for being a part of One Heat Minute. It's been an absolute treat to have you, and your, as I said, Hall of Fame moment is crushing on Robert De Niro in the 90s when there are all those other 90s heartthrobs, including Luke Perry, Keanu Reeves, etc., and you were all about Bobby, so I love it so much. Thank you so much for being a part of the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I do appreciate it. This was a lot of fun.
You're welcome. Thank you. It has been fun. Guys, at Film Intuition is where you can find Jen Johans and her website, filmintuition.com. You can jump straight onto Twitter right now. You can find all that. And again, she will update periodically, new review updates, and there's just a stack of great content there. So I want to thank Jen a lot again for being a part of the show. Thank you, Jen.
Okay, thank you. You have a good one.
You too. Garth Franklin, thank you for our web design. Paul Davies, thank you for our theme. And folks listening, catch you on another episode of One Heat Minute just around the corner, where a man protagonist will forego happily ever after to tip the scales of justice and, you know, maybe do a righteous kill that's not the terrible movie Righteous Kill.
Very true.